You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tekert. We have spent a lot of time here covering the surge in the cost of housing in the Bay Area and what that's meant for everything from homelessness to inequality to traffic. Now, these are problems that mostly get left to city governments to deal with. And if there is one lesson from the last 5 years of city-level problem solving, it's that city governments by themselves are not particularly up to the task. Now, as it turns out, the Bay Area is just the bleeding edge of a national trend of rising housing costs. And our next guest is part of a team that has proposed tackling housing as a national policy issue. Ryan Cooper is national correspondent for TheWeek.com, co-author of a new report from the People's Policy Project called Social Housing in the U.S. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with your big picture diagnosis on housing in the United States. Why are housing costs so bad? Why are they going up so quickly?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that in tons and tons of places in the United States, housing prices are not going up. You know, you look at a place like Detroit or a place like Buffalo, or even, you know, some more Sunbelt sprawly cities, they've not had nearly the kind of price increases that you see in New York City or Washington, D.C., or especially I think San Francisco has the worst case of it. So it's very localized in certain areas. And I think that reflects the fact that on the one hand, yes, the housing market, the provision of housing is severely broken in these communities, but it's also reflects background inequality.
I actually want to start by situating your shop for our listeners. I've never read anything from the People's Policy Project before. As I understand it, it just came together last year. Who are you?
The center, the president of the of People's Policy Project is a guy named Matt Brunig, who more or less set it up on his own recognizance, but he's a really kind of polymath guy who's funded this thing entirely through donations. And so there's no institutional, you know, compromises that you have to make to get foundation grants or that sort of thing. And so he just does whatever he, you know, wants to do, and has funded several papers about this sort of thing, not to mention a whole bunch of other smaller sort of analyses. So, you know, government surveys and wealth surveys and, you know, all sorts of publicly available data, doing the kind of analysis that, you know, would many people, I'm sure, at other more liberal think tanks like Center for American Progress would like to do, but are hemmed in by having to take money from Walmart and such like.
Right. And in this country, our housing system is mostly a private one. Private developers decide where and when to build. Local governments decide what kind of obstacles to put in their paths. What's your diagnosis on why we're coming up so short?
Well, again, it's a complicated story going back a long time, but I think the sort of post-New Deal government housing subsidy structure was about building a certain kind of aesthetic for a certain kind of person. And that's like middle class to upper middle class to wealthy people living in detached single family homes out in the suburbs, dependent on cars, in a very spread out, very low density sort of structure. And that includes, you know, the whole complex of institutions, the creation of the secondary mortgage market. You know, the 30-year mortgage didn't exist before the New Deal, and federally insured mortgages to vastly lower the default rate, or the risk rather, to the banks making these loans. And the overall effect is basically to divert huge quantities of, you know, real resources into constructing sprawly suburbs for middle class and up white people. And, you know, a more efficient and a more racially neutral way of constructing housing got little or no focus. You know, you have these tiny little scraps of policy. You know, the low-income housing tax credit, which is, you know, something like $8 billion, and it'll be even less under this new tax bill.
And then direct public housing subsidy, which is even less than that. And so before the New Deal, and even after it to some degree, like creating a sort of healthy urban environment with that could support decent public transportation and so forth was just massively biased against, according to the way that the federal subsidy structure was set up. And, you know, I think we're sort of coming to the end of that. The basic housing system is sort of falling apart, you know, to where increasingly, you know, people can't afford even those kind of mortgages. The prices are increasing to the out of reach of the normal person, which, you know, is partly due to inequality again, but it's also due to thinking of housing as the middle class savings investment. In fact, this is maybe the biggest contradiction of all, because the way housing has been thought of, you know, is a way it's been sold by generations of politicians. Oh, it's the middle class investment. And in fact, most middle class wealth is in housing. But housing is a weird investment. It doesn't, you know, increase in productivity. You know, your house just falls apart. And, you know, in many cities, one partial result of this is just a wildly spiraling housing price increase, you know, completely unmoored from any sort of rational valuation there. And people are priced out, you know.
Yeah, one of the most striking figures from your article was how over the course of the last 15 years, from 2001 to 2016, the proportion of new housing getting built that's getting built for the luxury end of the market has skyrocketed from about 15% of units coming online to 40% of units coming online. And again, that's not just the Bay Area, that's nationally.
Yeah, that's right, because, you know, that's where the money is.
And why wasn't the money there in 2001?
Well, I think you'd have to dig into the details of that specifically to know for certain. But my sense is that 2001 is before the whole housing bubble. And after the housing crash in 2006, you know, the 2012 or something like that, there's this massive pent up backlog of housing. You know, residential investment fell to its lowest level ever in this national statistics, and it stayed there for like 5 years. And so there's this giant backlog. And so that meant the demand was really, really high. And so when the demand is high, people go for the highest margin unit, and that's inevitably a luxury unit. You can even get people, you know, people paying 30, 40, 50, 60% of their income in rent because there's so much demand for it.
So around here, the principal tool that cities have deployed to try to deal with that phenomenon, that the market only seems to want to build luxury units for the relatively affluent, is something called inclusionary zoning. That means the city passes a rule that says any development above a certain size, X percentage of units have to be affordable to people living at X percent of the area median income. How does that strike you as a tactic for coping with the housing crisis?
I think it's not nuts. In theory, it's certainly like a kind of reasonable compromise, and it's certainly better than not doing that and just letting people go for whatever they want. But I think the main problem is that, you know, number one, the number of affordable units you're generally talking about is like a couple dozen, you know, per just tiny, tiny little numbers of units that just like wildly outstrip any possible demand. And then secondly, the way they structure these rules is often that, you know, once you can get permission to build a new unit with these things, if you can, you know, demonstrate that your old building is, you know, unoccupied, or, you know, raise the rent up above a certain level. And so there's sometimes perverse incentives in these systems that allow people to, you know, basically clean out a bunch of rent stabilized tenants, knock the building down, and then build the thing that's like 75% luxury units and, you know, a handful of affordable ones. And so I think it's also like a lot of times these cities have trouble actually paying attention to what's happening. You know, it's like you look at, there's a story about Jared Kushner, for example, doing just like blatantly illegal things, kicking out rent stabilized tenants by failing to perform legally required maintenance and stuff like that, and just like getting a slap on the wrist over and over and over again because these blue cities are often really corrupt. And so, you know, it's just like it's sort of like Obamacare in a way. You have like a finicky sort of compromise, but in the implementation stage, it's often a bit of a mess.
So the discussion at the state level about policy changes has been mostly about removing obstacles to development. There's one bill that went into effect that removes a lot of permitting hurdles for housing developments, and another that was defeated in committee this year, but will probably come back up, that would eliminate zoning restrictions on dense housing near transit. What do you think of the deregulatory approach to getting more housing built?
Yeah, I mean, I understand the impetus there, but I really I would first push back against this deregulation idea, because, you know, that signals libertarianism, and it just brings along a huge complex of very toxic ideas. And I don't think it's accurate either, because what you're doing is not deregulating. You're re-regulating, you know, you're changing the rules. And that's kind of the case with every instance of deregulation. It's never the case that the state is being removed from the equation. It's just like changing the context of how, you know, the rules that exist and how they work. And in this case, a way that would work more quickly on behalf of, you know, private developers. I think that, you know,
but there's a political economy argument behind that approach, and they argue that in a lot of the suburban cities, like you referenced in the Bay Area, that have not accommodated much housing expansion, local politics is basically controlled by single family homeowners, and they have no skin in the game. If the housing supply remains restricted, their home values go up. They actually come out ahead.
Yeah, that's correct. And that is indeed what, you know, as I've been saying, that was what the whole 20th century middle class housing policy was designed, the behavior it was designed to inculcate. And is not surprising to me that people have, a lot of duplicitous arguments about, oh, neighborhood character and blah, blah, blah. And really, I think at root, the question is preserving people's major asset. But I think that, you know, that is correct. That is the interest group you kind of have to get around. And I think the one, you know, the problem with the way that the YIMBY crowd, you know, the quote unquote deregulation crowd has framed itself is that they have put anybody who cares about affordability, you know, sort of to the side. It's like you can say in a counterfactual that if you built lots of housing across the, you know, whole state, you know, prices would come down. And that may be a good thing, you know, especially in, say, you know, 10 or 20 years when you can really have all this housing coming online, all the projects are finished and the prices get bid down a bit. But in the meantime, in specific neighborhoods, you know, where people putting in these private developments, you know what they're going to look like, and you know that the local prices are probably going to go up. And so people, you know, who are on the bottom, who are not homeowners, are also, you know, they sort of making common cause with the NIMBY homeowners in some way. But I think if you had a different approach with the, you know, that more emphasized the, you know, some of the ideas that myself and Peter Gowan have been talking about in our paper, I think you'd have a chance of building a broader coalition. And it would also be better on the merit.
That paper is Social Housing in the United States. It's from the People's Policy Project. We're speaking to the co-author of that paper, Ryan Cooper, who's a national correspondent for TheWeek.com. So we've gone through kind of the prevailing models in California, the inclusionary zoning that some of the more expensive cities are trying to do, putting low-cost housing into new market rate developments, and the state-level push for deregulation for lifting some zoning restrictions on new development to mobilize more private capital for housing production. You've proposed a third way. Do you want to lay out the social housing argument? First of all, what is social housing by your definition?
Social housing is just state-owned housing, and we call it social housing to distinguish it from traditional American public housing, which is very heavily means-tested such that only poor people can live there. And we're just basically following a European approach in places like Finland, Sweden, or Vienna. And the idea is a state-owned housing where basically anybody is eligible to live there. And so instead of having the, private developer go in, do a sort of cost analysis and build the most profitable building that he or she wants to build or can get past the, political obstacles, you look at the kind of housing that, the government wants to see, and then you just directly build that. The advantage of this approach is that, number one, governments often own a lot of land. So there's at least, some places, low or zero cost of acquisition. They also have much lower cost of capital for most cities compared to private developers. And then when you're building social housing, you can build just exactly the sort of units that you want to build. Luxury units tend to be larger. They tend to waste a lot of space on amenities like, lobbies and concierge service or a lot of exercise equipment and so forth. Whereas with this, you can just really pack units in. And finally, you avoid the negative downsides of public housing in the American style, which is where you concentrate poor people, so you end up with creating a lot of high crime neighborhoods, and the units always require a big subsidy because poor people can't pay any rent. But this way, if you have regular people paying more regular rent, then there'll be a ton more money coming in, and it'll be much cheaper compared to the actual cost on the government books. And you can sort of create one of the things that I almost like most about it is you look at these places, these developments in Vienna and so forth. It's just a very very egalitarian sort of setup. It's like a kind of very neighborhoody type of place where lots of different sorts of people are living side by side, and it's like you're kind of utopian lefty kind of picture. But in terms of very, very pragmatic considerations, this is strictly superior if you're just focused on cost of housing, rental housing in these sort of situations. And so I think, I'm not I'd be willing to make common cause with the YIMBY folks if they wanted to, make some sort of a compromise bill. But certainly I think the way that we've set forward, even if it may require a lot more initial government outlays in terms of building and so forth, is both a superior policy and a much more politically palatable, I suspect, in a very blue state like California.
Well, that's the argument I've principally heard from YIMBY people when confronted with this type of proposal, is that the government doesn't have the money. Raising the kind of money it would take to do what you describe might provoke a massive political backlash. Why do you think it's viable? Like, how much housing are we talking about to actually address the crisis? How much money would it take, and where would you get it from?
Well, we suggest starting with 10 million units nationwide. And details are important here. Obviously California has that crazy, Proposition 13? The property tax restriction. It's a kind of a steep uphill battle there, but I think it would be possible to sell. I mean, the home ownership rate in California is only like 53-54%, I think it would be possible to sell people in general on the idea that if you have to raise some taxes, then you build, you know, something that would benefit a pretty broad spectrum of the population. And depending on, you know, financing details, you could imagine these being financed almost entirely out of the rents of the people who are living there. You know, it's just like, if a private developer can do it, you know, who are often not particularly efficient, especially in this country, but, you know, you ought to be able to, in theory, build a social housing project that more or less pays for itself or pretty closely. Obviously, that's a little bit speculative, but the reason we wrote, you know, this paper is to try to push the boundaries of this sort of discourse and not preemptively surrender to the very, very neoliberal kind of libertarian framework, which has dominated the housing policy discussion for the last few years.
So to recap the proposal here, it's to give local governments, city governments, money to build housing that, unlike the public housing projects of yore, would include enough high-cost rental housing to pay the overhead for the people who would be effectively subsidized with low rents in those same developments. But you're asking the city to play the role of developer and also landlord.
More or less correct, yes. Similar to how the original public housing system was set up in the 30s, just a much bigger and much more egalitarian way that's not means tested. And hopefully, you know, it would be a win-win-win for everybody involved, such that, you know, poor people are getting better, higher quality units. The middle people are paying lower than they would have otherwise, even if it's much more than the poor people. And the market rate would be lower than that would be relative to no public housing at all, because you'd be putting downward pressure on the market price as well.
All right, Ryan Cooper, thanks very much for speaking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Cooper is national correspondent for TheWeek.com. He's co-author of the new report from the People's Policy Project entitled Social Housing in the United States.